Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. These are unusual times in which we're living. Hopefully you and your families are keeping safe. The recent response to this podcast has been really appreciated by Social Justice Ireland. Over the last few weeks, we've moved to focus almost solely on interviews on issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the last four episodes have been the four fastest downloaded of all our episodes so far. There are now more than 20 available, but it's great to see that there is such an interest in the material we've been putting together. Our four most recent episodes include a chat with Tom McDonnell of the Nevin Economic Research Institute on the economic response to COVID-19, with Orla Hegarty of UCD on the housing implications of the virus, and with Bernard Joyce of the Irish Traveller Movement. Last week's episode featured our CEO, Dr. Sean Healy, talking about the positives and negatives contained within the recently released Fine Gael Fianna Fáil draft document, a document that'll probably form a framework for the future programme for government negotiations. Maybe check out one or two of these episodes, and if you like what you hear, you can email us at secretary@socialjustice.ie, and we'll add you to our mailing list so you can be notified of new podcast episodes, publications, and any upcoming events we'll be holding, albeit it'll probably be a while yet before we're holding face-to-face gatherings, unfortunately. This week, I got to chat to Maeve Bateman, Director at Financial Justice Ireland. Our organisations are not related, despite the similar names, and Financial Justice Ireland is actually a relatively recent moniker. Many of our listeners will remember them as the Debt and Development Coalition Ireland, or DDCI, as they were known until a couple of years ago. Maeve and I spoke about some of the issues facing the developing world at this time of global crisis, and this episode will likely be a real eye-opener for many listeners on the scale of the issues faced by poorer countries as they try to balance responding to COVID-19 with the financial obligations placed on them by richer countries, including ourselves. Do enjoy, and check back here again soon for more episodes. I'm here with Maeve Bateman, Director of Financial Justice Ireland. We're sitting down for a remote chat, of course, given the times that we're living in. Maeve, thanks very much for taking the time to sit down and have a talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
NGOs and civil society organisations like ourselves have spent, you know, so much of the last 6 weeks or so reacting to the COVID-19 pandemic, and every organisation's area of focus has differed depending on the area they work in and the priorities they've identified based on analysis of the situation. I mean, the work of Financial Justice Ireland is based around the countries of the so-called Global South or low-income countries of the developing world, and it's fair to say that whatever impacts we're feeling here in the rich world, they're going to be doubly felt over there. They don't have, generally speaking, the relatively well-funded welfare states or health systems that we do, much less scope for many of them to work from home. I mean, it's obvious that they're going to require some assistance in the situation. And one of the most obvious areas that we can help is around the idea of sovereign debt relief. I mean, why don't you begin by telling our listeners a bit about what you think is required in the current situation?
Sure. Also, so maybe a bit of background first is that Financial Justice Ireland actually started off our life under the name Debt and Development Coalition Ireland. And so we were actually founded in response to the last big debt crisis, which some of your listeners might remember, part of a big call coming up to the millennium calling for debt relief in the Global South. Now, there was some limited success in response to that. There were some debts that were written off. But those of us working in the global debt cancellation movement and the global debt movement, we've been worried for some time now that a lot of developing countries were starting to see their debt burdens increase. There was a brewing storm, and this was something that was already being acknowledged even before this current crisis. So the World Bank and IMF spring meetings, which happened very recently and were obviously meant to happen physically, and obviously changed very much in light of the current context. But one of the topics that was going to be raised at them was this growing concern about debt burdens that countries were already facing and the implications that this was having. So as soon as this crisis hit, we were incredibly concerned about what that would mean for countries which, you know, like our own, would suddenly be facing this urgent need to increase spending on healthcare, to put in place infrastructure that might not be there, to potentially curtail people's movement. And so in countries where most workers are in the informal sector, like you say, they could be cash in hand, they have to physically be where they are to do their work, and there aren't the social protections in place. There's this huge risk there. So a lot of actors came together quite quickly, a lot of NGOs working on this, civil society organizations, and we issued a statement calling for a debt jubilee to tackle the health and economic crisis that will come out of COVID-19. And so we called for an urgent cancellation of all external debt payments due to be made in 2020 and the provision of emergency additional finance, which would not create debt. So they're kind of the most basic things. And we also called yet again for some steps to be put in place that would resolve the ongoing debt crisis. So the creation through the UN of a process for sovereign debt restructuring and clear guidelines so that where a debt is unsustainable, there's a roadmap for countries to follow. And the reason we did this, there are a number of reasons, but I suppose the clearest ones are cancelling debt repayments is immediate. It has such a huge instant effect on countries' finance. It's much faster than waiting for new aid to be agreed or to be received. It means governments can immediately reallocate money that they were planning on paying as debt repayments to their healthcare systems, and they can do that now. It's shocking to, I find this statistic incredible, but there are currently 64 developing countries that spend more on debt repayments than on healthcare. So that, wow. Yeah, like that is just incredible that's the case, even notwithstanding the fact that we're in a pandemic. And it gives some sense of the scale of what we're talking about, the impact it has on these countries. And so that was sort of something we felt we needed urgently to do. We issued a statement and it was done in conjunction with a number of regional networks throughout the world. So Eurodad in Europe, Afrodad in Africa, and Latindad in Latin America. And in Ireland, a number of Irish organisations signed on to this. We've written letters to the ministers for finance and foreign affairs. We've launched a bit of an online campaign asking people to let the government know that this is something that requires urgent action now.
Okay, so but this was a problem, you know, long before COVID-19 appeared on the horizon. And so it's really a case that this has exacerbated the problem. Is that it?
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose the history of sovereign debt crises in the global south, it's a long one and it goes back quite a while, but it's ultimately rooted in colonialism, really. For a lot of countries where their debt crises started was in the aftermath of their independence. But really, since the 1970s oil crisis, there was a huge push from Western banks who had a lot of money deposited as a result. A lot of oil money went into Western bank accounts. They wanted a way to invest this. And they lent significantly to governments in sub-Saharan Africa, to governments in Latin America. Those loans increased huge, essentially about fourfold over that time period during the 70s, the amount of money that they were receiving. But then these loans, generally, that they're given in currencies that the receiving country has no control over. So they receive a loan in, say, US dollars. They have to repay it in US dollars, but their own exports are reliant on prices in international markets, and their own currencies are pegged to the dollar, and they can see a huge decrease in the amount of money available to them to repay these debts. So during the 70s and 80s, where the US government then increased interest rates to reduce their own inflation, it meant that payments for debtor governments were hugely increased. The relative size of their debt was hugely increased, and they were in a terrible situation. Now that situation led to the call for debt relief through the 90s. And now what's happened in recent years has a lot to do with speculation in commodities markets, and a lot to do, again, with just their vulnerability and exposure to an increasingly financialized world. Another kind of striking fact that I find quite staggering is some of the debt payments that have been coming due around about now, so debt payments that have been written off are debts that were incurred by countries responding to the Ebola crisis. So, you know, there's these cycles where we respond to crises by lending more money, and then countries end up in more debt and end up in another crisis, either through something happening externally or just the fact itself of the money that they owe not being repayable.
It sort of makes sense what you're saying there, that as regards finding an immediate way to channel money to these countries to respond to the pandemic, debt cancellation or at least postponement frees up money a lot more quickly than aid does. I mean, what kind of scales are we talking about in dollar terms, we'll say? I mean, I presume this runs into multiple billions.
Yeah, so basically for poor countries faced with tackling coronavirus in 2020, you're looking at more than $24 billion of debt, and that's just the debt that's due in 2020.
Oh, that's for 1 year only?
That's for 1 year only. So what's at issue with what has been suggested at the moment as a response to this? Because the announcements that have been made and the responses that have been made so far, there have been some write-downs, but a lot of it has been suspension of debt. And so what that ultimately means is it's being carried forward to a future point. So they might say, OK, we're not going to require you to repay the money in 2020, but you're going to have to repay it in 2021 on top of what you were already going to have to repay in 2021. These countries are in a similar, if not worse, situation than we are. So we've seen on the news the last few days here talks about a 10% contraction in our own economy. If you're in the global south, you're looking at similar kind of figures, what's happening in the global economy where you're very, very exposed. You know, how are you going to feel comfortable investing this money in your healthcare system, knowing that you're going to be facing increasing debts in coming years? It's not being written off. It's just being carried forward, and the debt burden gets even higher.
OK, and there's pressure coming from civil society organisations such as yourselves, and Social Justice Ireland is happy to be part of that coalition as well. But who are the lenders that are involved? Who are the organisations, or is it private investors who are the targets of this campaign?
So there's a real mix. So still, and it depends a lot on the country makeup, who the predominant lenders are. So back when sort of the first kind of response to debt crises happened kind of 20 odd years ago, a lot of the lenders were multilaterals. It was easier to sort of target and say, you know, look at the IFIs, the World Bank and the IMF, look at some more of the regional banks. At the moment, the sort of for the 76 low and middle income countries, the kind of debt cancellation that would free up about $40 billion for them, it would include a makeup of about $18 billion owed to multilateral lenders, $12.4 billion owned to bilateral lenders, and $10 billion owned to private lenders. And so to explain what those terms mean a bit, so when we talk about the multilateral lenders, we're basically talking about lenders where the money is coming from a mix of governments ultimately. So like the IMF and the World Bank, all their members are governments. You've also got, say, the Asian Development Bank, regional banks like that, to even the European Investment Bank. They're all multilateral lenders made up of a number of different actors, but government-based actors. Bilateral lending in that case, it's country-to-country lending. And then there's the private lenders. So it's a higher proportion of private lenders than it used to be, but that's still looking at about three quarters of that coming from basically state lending.
And roughly what percentage then would be, I mean, presumably there's some contribution to this from, say, the likes of hedge funds or what we might refer to as vulture funds and that kind of thing.
So where vulture funds tend to act, they are sort of experts in buying up distressed debt. So actually for many of the countries most at risk of default, it's likely that's where the vulture funds tend to come in. They specialise in purchasing distressed loans. So generally, the way sovereign debt works is it's often a country will issue bonds. Those bonds will then be traded. So that debt, it gets moved around. And for countries who are holding, or for private individuals who are holding bonds for countries that look risky, they're more likely to essentially try and sell those debts on at a loss in hope of at least recovering something if they fear a default is looking likely. The people who specialize in buying those are vulture funds, who tend to work on the assumption that if they buy enough of those debts that look unlikely to be paid, and then they pursue quite aggressive legal strategies, they only need to be successful in a certain percentage of them to get huge profits. And to be aware, or to be clear, when they are successful, they're not getting back the money they paid for that debt. They're getting back the original money that was that sort of the headline sum. So they're often making many, many 100% return on their investment.
I guess the question then, the big question that we have to look at is, how do you finance the response that's necessary in these developing countries? I presume it's going to have to revolve primarily around grant aid rather than fresh loans that are just going to add to this pile of debt that's accumulated.
Yeah, I mean, what we would kind of call for is a few different things. So firstly, there's the need to ensure that there's a debt cancellation and a moratorium brought in to enable the immediate freeing up of payments that were due to be made. But secondly, is the fact that any additional aid that is promised has to come in the form of grants, and ideally has to be additional, because what we're seeing already is grant aid being announced, but really what it actually is money that would have been given anyway, maybe under a different budget line, being moved to healthcare. So obviously countries will need additional support for this. It's an unprecedented crisis. But what they don't need is money that will have to be paid back. And what they don't need ideally is money that was going to be invested in their education system now being moved to healthcare. Obviously, that's probably a better and more necessary place for it right now. But it would be much better if that was additional income rather than just a budgetary reallocation, essentially.
And you mentioned the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank, which took place earlier this month. I mean, was there any key decisions taken at those meetings that are going to have an effect on the situation we're talking about?
So the IMF announced a write down of 215 million, which was promised that 215 million US dollars of debt payments for 25 countries will be cancelled over the next 6 months. And we absolutely welcome that. It's a very important first step. But I think we feel it falls far short of what is actually required, because when you look at that repayment, it only works out to about 1% of all low-income country debt. So they've chosen 25 countries, the lowest income countries there. But if you actually broaden that out a little bit and into a larger group of countries, so if you look at 76 kind of low and middle income countries who are eligible for aid from the IMF, who make up the IDA, that would be where you get the figure of 40 billion being owed. And you can see 215 million is just a very, very low amount.
That's less than 1% of the overall amount. It's a drop in the ocean, really.
Yeah, and this is sort of the challenge. There has also been an announcement made by the G20. They've announced that they'll suspend all bilateral lending. So suspensions of all debt incurred from bilateral lending from G20 members between May and December 2020 for 77 countries. So this is, again, it's welcome, but this is not cancelling debt. This is simply suspending debt. So this will become due for repayment within 4 years. And ultimately, this is just going to worsen the economic conditions faced by low-income countries, because there is going to be a global recession, unfortunately. We know this. And we know that we're looking at economic growth, according to the IMF's own predictions, in low-income countries going from 5.4% in 2019 to maybe 0.4% in 2020. So already these countries are going to be struggling. Increasing their debt burdens is just, it's very clearly not going to be something that will help.
It kind of sounds like there's an acknowledgement, certainly, that something needs to be done. a sort of acknowledgement of what actually needs to be done, although not quite getting all the way there. But the scale in which the reaction has taken place so far just sounds way short of what's actually required. I guess maybe one of the more pertinent questions for our listeners is, what's Ireland's role in all of this? What influence do we hold at these institutions that we could possibly leverage? And what's the role of Irish international aid in all of this?
I mean, generally speaking, I think Irish international aid or our overseas development assistance, it has a very good reputation. We don't generally, as a country, we don't usually go for tied aid or anything like that. Our aid is generally very high quality. We have a very good international reputation on those points. And so I guess we'd see it as, this is an opportunity for us to kind of come out and be a leading voice in this. We are members of the IMF and the World Bank. We're obviously within the European Union, we would have a voice. And I think just being a voice and using our influence to say we want to publicly call for these debts to be cancelled will be important. Another key thing that we could do is say that we support the call for a debt workout mechanism under the auspices of the UN, which is something that was voted for in the UN General Assembly in 2014, and which we voted against in that vote. And this would be a structure where it would mean that countries who are struggling with debt repayments would have a process they could go through. Because, as you know, if you're an individual and you're struggling with debt, there's a bankruptcy process. There are now additional insolvency processes you can go through as an individual. There are steps that you can take. For sovereign debt, for countries, there's none of this. In fact, most bonds that are taken out and are traded, they tend to fall. But the bonds that developing countries issue, they will generally fall under either UK law or New York State law. So for these countries, they have absolutely no say or influence under this. It gives the, particularly with the private lenders involved in this and the vulture funds, they have a significant unfair advantage in terms of like the cost to take these cases through those jurisdictions. So if we put that process in place, it will be a roadmap. It will be a lot, it'll offer a lot of clarity to countries, and there'll be a way through it. Because otherwise you're looking at a situation where countries are faced with the choice of, well, either I pay this debt or I pay these nurses. You know, I kind of have to slash public services, have to bring about severe austerity measures. And that's what we've seen time and time again. And in a public health pandemic that's happening at a global level, it's just not something that we can really morally allow to happen. So I think what we'd really call for as a longer term solution to this is for those structures to be put in place so that countries can avoid the heartache of this debt crisis again.
Well, it kind of sounds like this debt crisis is just one part of a broader international financial system that's stacked very much against some of these lower income countries, particularly once they've fallen into a cycle of unsustainable debt. To what extent is it the broader system that they're a part of that's at the heart of this issue?
I mean, for us as an organisation, I suppose our overarching belief is that you can't tackle poverty and inequality until you have a finance system that's democratic and that is focused on the needs of people first. And so we'd see the current international financial system as being inherently undemocratic and hugely negatively impacting countries who are not wealthy, basically, who do not hold the power and who are struggling with the effects of that. So for a country, the sort of the two sides of the one coin, really, in terms of how a country funds public services for its citizens, you get your income through taxation and essentially through borrowing for longer term work. And so you have the debt side of it, and then you have the tax side of it. And so we see the outflows of capital from countries in the global south is truly, truly staggering. And that's all being facilitated by gaps in the international financial system and to a certain extent by designs in the international financial system. So one of the other key areas we work on is tax. And for many countries, it's the fact at the moment, countries in receipt of aid, there's more income lost that flows from the global south to the global north than goes the other direction in aid, which is not the impression that you would get kind of looking at the news or looking at how things are reported. But in reality, countries like ours are receiving quite a lot of money that comes from those countries. And in a number of cases, this is because of gaps in taxation laws, loopholes that are being exploited. And the reality is, again, so we talked about the need for a debt workout mechanism. But when it comes to tax, the laws that govern this, the agreements that govern these practices, at the moment, the processes are under the OECD, which is essentially a rich countries club. So these countries in the global south have absolutely no say over these rules or how they're written, how they affect them, how they're put into practice. And similarly, in terms of investment, so we had an event the week before last with a number of great speakers looking at how finance and COVID-19 were going to affect countries in the global south. And one of our speakers was talking about the role of privatization historically in public-private partnerships, which are something that actors like the World Bank and the IMF have been pushing in the global south. And in reality, these structures, they enable investors, global investors, to get profit from countries who are struggling to cover basic healthcare needs. Kind of things like user fees can often be huge disincentives for individuals. And so you've countries who are struggling with these quite basic requirements, and yet international investors are making a profit through healthcare systems. So ultimately, I think that there are a number of areas where we would say the international financial system needs significant reform if we're to bring to an end the levels of poverty and inequality that we're seeing.
I think it probably requires an acknowledgement from countries like ours as well that our tax systems don't do anything to assist these countries either, particularly if, as you say, the flows of taxable income out of those countries are considerably greater than any aid that might go towards them. I mean, I guess maybe some of our listeners might be wondering if there's anything they can do to lend support to campaigns in this regard.
Yeah, I mean, so with the debt campaign at the moment, we have an action that people can take on our website, calling Minister for Finance Pascal Donoghue to cancel the debt and save lives. So we're just financialjustice.ie, so people can log on and be part of that campaign, and generally can receive updates if they're interested in what we're doing with the campaign and in some of our other tax work. And we do have events and all happening online at the moment, obviously, about these issues if people are interested in learning more.
Hopefully this podcast will help generate some interest in that. I know that a lot of our supporters and a lot of the listeners to the podcast, this would be an issue that I think would be of great interest to them. Maeve, thanks a million for taking time from what I know is a very busy day for you to sit down and have a chat with us about this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Eamon. Really great to talk.
Thanks for listening. Hopefully you found this episode useful. As I say, if you want to email us at secretary@socialjustice.ie, we can add you to our mailing list and you can be notified of any future podcast episodes or any publications from the organisation or any future events. Until next time, stay safe.